The food was largely vegetarian, but there was a tiny bit of meat so unidentifiable that Michael Rourke elected not to touch any of the food. Vasily Prokopyev became nauseated merely looking at it. There were chopsticks for utensils. He knew now why they had returned his watch, so that he and Prokopyev could count the minutes remaining until their deaths. And less than an hour's worth of minutes at the outside remained. And there was no way to tell how soon before the guards would come for them. When Prokopyev's vomiting subsided, Michael, able now to walk quite well, the pain in his head constant and unforgiving but manageable, squatted down in front of the green-faced Prokopyev.
Are you game to try?
There is nothing to lose. Yes. What is your plan, Michael?
Take that bucket you puked into, spill the contents onto the floor over by the window, and lie down on the floor near it. I'll get them in here somehow. And when they go to look at you, I jump them both. As soon as you hear it go down, try and give me a hand, okay?
But,
Chopsticks can make excellent thrusting implements. Centuries ago, there were men who could throw them and use them as weapons. I don't know how to do that, but to a weak part of the neck, to the solar plexus, the groin, into an eye or ear, they'll do some damage. Maybe enough so we can get a gun or a blade. Then we play it by ear. Odds are good we'll get killed trying, but a death like that beats what they've got planned, right?
This is true. Should I lie down now?
Yes.
Rourke, should we survive?
What?
I would regret someday killing you.
Well, you think you'd regret it. Here, I'll help you up.
He held Prokopyev to his feet over toward the window. Prokopyev flexed his left fist in order to restore circulation. They stopped beside the window, Michael looking down into the commons below. The missile was clearly an altar. Looking nearly as small as ants, he remembered the creatures from the time before the great conflagration, were women performing some ritual before it. He went for the bucket which had been provided for their toilet use, which was now filled with vomit. Trying to close his nose, he felt nauseated himself, he spilled the contents across the floor near where Prokopyev lay.
Be ready, Vasily.
The chopsticks, both sets, made of a type of plastic rather than wood, but rigid, were concealed up his sleeves. On impulse, he ran across the room and picked up a bowl of what could have been soup. It was still hot. He went back beside the door, looking for a place to put the bowl.
Ah.
He set it on the floor within reach, placing a cushion over it. There was no hard furniture of any kind. The food had been brought in by two regular army enlisted men. The bowls carried on trays. The trays taken away. The bowls set on the floor.
Here goes.
Hey! He's sick! Maybe dying! Get him the hell out of here! He's throwing up all over everything! Come on, damn it!
If one of their number spoke English, however stiffly, like the woman with the dead eyes, then it was always possible someone outside the door spoke English as well.
Come on, it smells in here! Open up!
The door began to open, the two unpleasant-looking Mongols he had seen earlier stepping partially into the room. One of the men began to crinkle his nose at the smell of the vomit.
See what I mean? This smells like shit! Worse than that! Maybe I'm gonna be ripped limb from limb, but I shouldn't have to put up with this! Come on!
The other guard, apparently the smell bothered him less, gestured for Michael to step back. Michael stepped closer to the hidden bowl of soup. Each was armed with a pistol and a saber, both men with their pistols drawn. The first guard went for Prokopyev. The second stayed near Michael, who let one of the chopstick pairs slide out of his cuff, the other pair more secure under the band of his Rolex. Michael turned to face the guard.
The poor guy's dying, but what a smell.
Michael's right hand arced upward, and both chopsticks in his right hand rammed into the Mongol's left eyeball.
Yes.
The Mongol's gun went off as Michael threw himself to the floor, the first guard wheeling around toward him.
Huh?
Michael caught him in the face with the bowl of hot soup.
Yes.
The soup splashed over the first guard's face. Michael saw the pistol come up, but he was already moving, the second pair of chopsticks in his hand. The chopsticks jutted out from the guard's throat, blood pumping thickly down his shirt. The man fell to the ground, his eyes already glazing over. The other guard, the chopsticks sticking out of an empty eye socket, wasn't moving.
We've got to get out of here. Grab his saber, Glock, and any ammo you can find.
A quick check of the guards' bodies revealed two spare magazines each.
These Glocks have a totally passive safety system. Just pull the trigger. Make sure to take the guard saber. Hurry!
You go ahead.
Nats, they're already coming.
Michael went for the door, the Glock 17 in one hand, the saber in the other. The corridor bent less than 10 yards away. There could have been an army around the bend, and he'd have no way of knowing. Vasily Prokopyev was beside him. Michael stepped into the corridor.
That way!
He nodded toward the opposite end of the corridor from which he heard the sounds of running feet. Prokopyev beside him, moving too slowly. But Michael Rourke had no intention of leaving the man behind, KGB officer or not. Human beings, he had been raised to believe, didn't do that sort of thing to other human beings, regardless of who they were. They soon reached the end of the corridor. There, where the corridor abruptly stopped, was a stairwell, the stairs leading interminably downward, it seemed, corridors branching off from the ever-circling stairs periodically. But at the center of the stairwell, reachable by walking out on a wheel-spoke-shaped platform, was a fire pole.
Time to play Batman?
Bat what?
Tell you about the Caped Crusader later, okay? Shove the gun in your pants and give me a 30-second start, then do what I do.
All right.
With the saber's edge, Michael cut away the bandages beneath the sling which braced Prokopyev's dislocation, keeping the right arm bound to the right side at the upper arm, the forearm slung.
Hold on to the sling for later, but you'll need both hands now. This won't feel good.
He moved Prokopyev's arm outward.
Ah!
Prokopyev's knees buckled, but with Michael's help, he remained standing.
Get out there and give me your saber!
Prokopyev started along one of the spokes of the wheel, the spoke ending at the large central ring within which the pole was set.
You have to hold on just tight enough to slow your rate of descent, or otherwise you'll hit bottom like a stone.
You have done this before?
Nope, but I watched a lot of television in the last 500 years.
The Mongols were almost there. Michael took up his saber and hurled it down the corridor. It was fended off by one of the Mongol rifles.
Be ready! 30 seconds, remember!
The second saber managed to hit a man, but there were still more coming. The Mongols fell back under the random spray. Stuffing the Glock into the side pocket of his BDU pants, he entered the wheel, stepped over the central rail, and held to the pole. He looked upward, the staircase spiraling several stories higher, the pole jutting to the top floor as well. The second city had, he presumed, been built into a mountain upward, similar to the German enclave in Argentina, and was of a totally different design than the first Chinese city.
Give them a half dozen shots. Watch how I do it and go for it. Good luck.
And to you, Michael Rourke.
Michael grabbed the pole more tightly and jumped. The pole's composition was of some sort of plastic, not unlike that used in the chopsticks he had improvised as weapons. His hands felt no heat from friction. His knees and ankles locked around it easily, the sensation of a controlled fall not totally unpleasant. He looked up and saw Prokopyev take to the pole. Michael looked below him, and suddenly there was a Mongol face and a saber pointing up at him. Clutching tighter to the pole with his left hand, his chest pressed against it, Michael's right hand went to the side pocket of his BDU pants for the gun, the snag-free design of the Glock 9mm paying off as he tore it free. The saber fell away and the Mongol tumbled after it, down along the length of the pole toward the bottom, still more than 100 feet below. Michael tried stuffing the pistol away but couldn't. Taking his finger out of the trigger guard, clutching the gun hand to the pole as well, skidding, sliding, heat finally starting to build up on his flesh. He was going too fast. Below him, the Mongol's body impacted the floor surface. Michael tried slowing himself, but while he had clung to the pole with only one hand, he had gathered too much momentum. He couldn't slow himself. The bottom was rushing up toward him as he clutched his booted feet to the pole. Michael sprawled to the ground, the wind knocked out of him. He turned his head, which was now aching more intensely. The dead Mongol was staring back at him, the skull neatly cracked and blood trickling down across the forehead and the bridge of the nose.
Thanks for the help.
Michael swayed toward the base of the pole, pocketing his gun. Prokopyev was coming too fast. There was nothing else for it. Michael reached down and maneuvered the hulking dead man toward the pole's base.
You go on. I am done.
Bullshit!
Michael reached for the wounded arm, hauling it across his shoulders.
I can hold them off. Run for your own life.
Shut up. We're going together.
Michael started ahead, Prokopyev's left wrist locked in Michael's left fist, Michael's right hand holding the partially shot out Glock 17, but there was no time to change magazines. They were in what seemed to be some sort of lobby, beyond it a doorless entryway, and beyond that the commons Michael had seen from above.
Oh, that must be for us.
He was almost running, dragging Prokopyev, who could, it seemed, barely walk. Prokopyev's face dripping sweat despite the cool temperatures of the air here. They were through the lobby, into the commons. Old Mongol vendors everywhere, younger people dressed alike in peasant clothes, looking like pajamas. Michael spotted soldiers rushing toward them. He raised his Glock straight up. Panic would slow the progress of the soldiers, even if just a little. They were midway along the commons, the white-robed women he had seen from above as the size of ants now clearly discernible. Braziers, smoke rising from them, placed before the base of the missile, the women running in panic as Michael dragged Prokopyev toward them and the shrine, if that was what it was, near the gates leading out of the commons to what?
Damn it! Vasily, give me your gun! Can you reach it?
My waistband. I am sorry, Michael.
Michael nearly dropped Prokopyev as he twisted his right hand for the gun, grasped it, and ripped it free. He fired over the heads of the oncoming soldiers, in their general direction, but without risking hitting bystanders. The gates were less than 100 yards off, but already starting to close. He quickened his pace.
Move those feet, soldier! Now!
Prokopyev was trying, lurching forward, Michael only half-dragging him now. 50 yards, the gates were nearly shut. A second city regular was dragging at one of the gates to close it faster. There were no bystanders nearby. The Maoist's body tumbled sideways and into the path of the automatically closing gate section, blocking it. Michael looked behind him. He'd come back if he made it. The missiles, the strangely beautiful, evil-looking woman. They had his guns, the knife old Jan had made for him. He'd be back. They passed through the gates, Michael having to practically drag Prokopyev through the gap. Michael let Prokopyev fall to his knees for an instant. He grabbed the partially crushed body of the Maoist away from the gate. They were in the open now, a vast field, some sort of platform set up near the far right side, to the west, he thought. It was gray-banded darkness just before the sun would wink over the horizon. There were high rocks 500 yards or so distant.
Let's go. Give me your hand.
Here.
Michael hauled the man fully over his shoulder into a fireman's carry. Michael threw himself into a heavy, shallow-strided run, Prokopyev's stolen Glock in his right fist.
Michael!
He didn't look back. He just pushed himself harder, his Glock pointed blindly behind him. Michael looked back. Mongol horsemen were riding down hard on him. In their hands, stretched between them, was a net. Michael aimed and fired. One of the ponies stumbled, regained its balance, the two riders out of sync now.
Michael! Michael!
Michael Rourke looked back, the net hurtling over them, the horses closing on them. Michael tried reaching for the Glock. There were a few shots left in it, but his right hand was bound up in the netting. Michael looked up just in time to see the rifle butt arc downward toward his face. The senior ranked among the pilots to have extracted Prokopyev and his reconnaissance party stood off to the side. The lieutenant, who, along with a private soldier, had reached the rendezvous, stood at attention immediately in front of the desk.
When the squadron overflew the battle zone, if I understand you correctly, comrade, there was nothing but carnage on either side of the gap, correct?
That is correct, comrade Colonel. In the far distance, as we climbed, a large party of men mounted on horseback could be seen, riding in the direction of the second Chinese city.
And you inspected the battle area?
That is correct, comrade Colonel. The body of the young American Rourke was nowhere to be found, nor the bodies of the comrade major, nor of Senior Sergeant Yaroslav. Two private soldiers were missing as well.
And you have no knowledge as to the whereabouts of the Chinese civilian and the German officer who went to locate this army the young Rourke spoke of?
That is correct, comrade Colonel. No attempt was made to follow them, as I was under strict orders by the comrade major to make all haste to the rendezvous site. Afterward, no trace of them could be seen from the air, nor any trace of the army which the young American referred to.
And the clogged fuel line caused one of your craft to be forced down, and following standard procedures, all of your flight landed and waited while the fuel line was repaired, thus necessitating a delay of some 2 hours.
Yes, Comrade Colonel. That is what happened.
No one is at fault here. Except perhaps Prokopyev, for naively trusting O'Rourke. And it would appear Prokopyev, Rourke, and the other personnel are likely prisoners of Second City forces.
He was thinking out loud, he knew, but Prokopyev's number two, Nikita Achinsky, a captain, could lead the raid on the Second City.
Nothing has changed. Rejoin your respective units. You, instruct Captain Achinsky to join me here in 5 minutes. The attacks will begin on schedule. Carry on.
He had no choice. The commitment was too great. Hahn and Hammerschmidt had watched it, powerless to intervene. Hahn had forcibly restrained Hammerschmidt, who cursed their luck. And now Hammerschmidt waited alone as he watched the crowds assembling before the gates of the second city. Through his binoculars, able to see Michael's face, bruised and bleeding, and the Russian held up beside him. A woman with long dark hair walked past them and then on toward the platform at the far edge, attended by a group of women in white robes and surrounded by a group of Mongols. Where was Han? Han Lucheng moved along the far edges of the crowd. He had originally hoped to throttle one of the Mongols privately, then steal clothing for Hammerschmidt. But it all moved too fast. There would be no time for any of that. The sun was rising, and the four horses with their heavy studded saddles, four of the Arabian mixes, powerful and fast, were already tethered at the four compass points. They were going to kill one first, then the other. The woman with the dragon robes, it had to be her, rose to the platform. General Wing joined her. Thousands of civilians and hundreds of troops, both regular army and Mongol mercenaries, mingling among the crowd. A solid phalanx of Mongols between the platform and the citizenry. As Han worked his way closer, he could see Michael and the Russian commander, Prokopyev, being brought forward. Michael under his own power. Prokopyev virtually dragged, his legs unmoving. Han Luchen's mind raced. If he could reach the platform area and create a diversion, but was Michael strong enough to attempt another escape? And to where? Han kept moving. If he could reach the platform, somehow get to the woman in the dragon robes, or Mao when he arrived, put a gun to one of their heads, it was the only thing he could think of, but he didn't think it would work. John Rourke consulted the map overlay on the instrument package.
We'll be in sight of the second city in another few minutes, but we'll head up into the rocks near it shown by the German overflights. We can make plans for penetration when we arrive. Follow me.
He made the special veer left toward the rocks he could already see in the distance.
Everybody actuate your muffler construction.
He was charging into nowhere, but he had no choice. But perhaps observing the entrance to the second city from the rocks nearby would tell him something.
Daddy, Michael's in terrible pain. I can feel it.
I know, sweetheart.
Mao ascended to the platform and approached the podium. The woman with the dragon robes, surrounded by her white-robed ladies, smiled serenely. Michael Rourke stood solemnly, the Russian standing only because he was supported on each side by a Mongol.
These Russian mercenaries led a death squad from the first city. Under questioning by Inquisitor Shan Chu, they have revealed their plans. A force from the first city is coming to attack us in our homes. For this reason, I declare that all men under the age of 40 are to take up arms. All women the age of 20 who are childless are to do the same. We shall meet the revisionist devils and destroy them before they can come to the second city and rape our women and slaughter our children. And the heads of these two Russian mercenaries, once their bodies have been torn into the four winds, shall ride before us as a warning of the savage justice of the second city dispensed to all those who would attack us. I offer these weapons, found on the two who are about to die, to the first among you who will step forward to destroy them.
As he spoke, he raised Michael's still-holstered guns, his knife, even his musette bag into the air over his head.
Who will first mount a stout horse and ride?
I will ride. My brother was killed by them. I will ride or kill the man who tries to stop me.
Michael turned to the man who had just spoken. It was Han Lucheng. He was near to the phalanx of horse guard Mongols, and he vaulted forward, jumping upward.
The small one! Let him come forward!
The phalanx parted, and Han flipped nimbly up onto the platform. And he stood before Mao, whose eyes were dark, dancing with hatred and amusement.
Your name?
I am Kang, Great Mao.
Kang, very well. Kang will ride!
Mao looked at him sideways.
Take what you wish from among these trinkets, Kang.
Han Lucheng bent over the low table on which they had been placed. He took Michael's double shoulder holster with the Berettas, slinging it over his own shoulders. He took Michael's pistol belt with the 4-inch 44 Magnum revolver and the survival knife. He cinched it to his left side, the revolver slung behind his saber hilt, the knife beside his holstered Glock automatic. He gathered up the loose spare magazines, the leather case of magazines, and the loaders for the revolvers, putting these in the sack slung from his left shoulder. He took the musette bag, slinging it to his body. His eyes caught Michael's eyes as he looked up to face Mao.
Great one. I leave these other fine weapons for the other riders.
He could carry no more.
Kang leaves these other weapons for other riders. Two rifles and a handgun of stainless steel. A stout knife. Much ammunition. Who steps forward to ride?
There were more volunteers than the phalanx of guards could hold back. Michael caught Han's eyes as the other volunteers were chosen. They were both sure not to betray any recognition, but the message was loud and clear. The three volunteers were selected. Han stood at their head, the woman with the dragon robes coming forward and standing in front of him, raising her hands to the multitude.
The Maidens of the Sun will escort these valiant riders to their steeds and pray as the evil ones are ripped to their four winds.
The women in the white robes who served the temple came forward, and the prettiest among them, but her eyes were lifeless, took Han's hands in hers and led him across the platform, down the low steps toward the horses. He chanced to look back. Michael Rourke was being taken forward. John Rourke edged along the rocks, the man shape hidden there, closer now. With the dark clothing, in the poor light, he could not tell the uniform, simply assumed the worst and hoped it was perhaps Hammerschmidt, or perhaps even his son, that somehow Annie had been wrong. He closed the gap.
Moving, you dog!
Herr Doctor?
Otto?
It is you.
Otto!
Rourke dropped down to cover next to Hammerschmidt. Ahead of them, thousands of people gathered before the gates of the second city in front of a large platform.
Where's Michael?
Hammerschmidt gave him the glasses in his hands. Rourke brought them to his eyes.
Look to the center of the crowd. He is there, Herr Doctor.
The woman with the dead eyes and the fancy robes looked into Michael's face, using her curious English again as she spoke.
It is a pity. The execution needed to be public, because the pit would have been a good challenge for someone like you. Perhaps the best fight we have seen.
The pit?
Hungry dogs. You can fight them before they kill you.
Gee, well, maybe next time.
Huh. You are first. I will lead you there. But if you touch me, the eyes of your friend will be gouged from his face before he is killed.
I wouldn't touch you. I might not be able to wash my hands.
Michael had seen it coming, but couldn't have done a thing with his hands tied behind his back. He felt his face burn, and he tasted blood. It was worth it. She started ahead, and he fell in behind her, across the platform, down the steps. Mongols on all sides of him, except ahead, two Mongols flanking the woman. Her hair swayed over her back as she walked. He looked ahead. Han was already mounted on a strapping gray mare, one of the white-robed girls with the clouded eyes holding the reins of his horse. He wondered what Han had in mind, and hoped it wasn't what he was thinking. It was just as fatal to be ripped apart three ways as four. They stopped between the four horses.
You might choose to struggle against the ropes. It will please those who are watching.
You bet.
His hands were unbound, but his wrists weren't released, simply rebound. One to one rope, one to another. Each of the ropes leading to one of the mounted horses. The one from his right arm leading to Han's. He was forced down to his knees, then flat to the ground, a saber at his throat. But his arms could still move. His ankles were tethered now, too, one rope leading to each of the other two horsemen and their animals. Flat on his back, he looked up into the sky for a moment.
Are you sure the sun's really up? Doesn't look like it to me.
His mind was racing. He could attempt to drag off the second rider with the rope leading from his wrist, but what about the ropes on his ankles? And what could Han do?
The sun is up. Goodbye, American.
The woman smiled, her eyes a window to incarnate evil, he thought. He looked at Han Luchen. Then, the white-robed girls stepped away from the horsemen. Maria Leuden had given up her motorcycle to Otto Hammerschmidt, not even time to adjust the helmet to fit him. Paul had dismounted the field radio from the back of his machine, instructing Maria how to call for the helicopter gunships he had requested be in waiting and to tell them to hurry. Natalia had already moved up, beside John Rourke. She could not see his face with the helmet that he wore. His parka was off, left with Maria Leuden, his double shoulder holsters exposed over the heavy sweater, the sweater bunched up in front, and the Detonic Scoremasters in the waistband of his trousers.
Time is up. We move out.
Natalia heard his voice through the headset. Her heart was beating rapidly, and she felt a lightheadedness.
Let's go!
John Rourke's jet-black special rocketed ahead, Natalia throttling out, just slightly behind him, Paul and Annie on the left flank, Otto Hammerschmidt on the right. It was a hastily conceived plan. As they entered the valley, coming down out of the rocks, they began to execute it, Paul and Annie breaking off toward the platform, Otto and Natalia falling in beside Rourke, toward the far side of the open expanse, Rourke going right up the middle, as he always did. Michael Rourke's head screamed at him with pain. He didn't know what the signal would be for the execution to begin. He did nothing. He didn't want to ruin Hahn's plan, if there was one. He could wait no longer, the ropes tensioning slowly outward. He tugged at the rope that led from his right wrist, the rope Hahn had. The rope slid free. It all came clear to him.
Hahn! A knife!
Hahn Luchen's animal wheeled. Hahn riding down on him, Michael reaching for the rope from his left wrist, grabbing at it as the other three horses started to run. Han's saber flashed. Michael was dragged by his legs, the ropes taut, and the horses galloping forward. To his left, he spotted a jet-black motorcycle coming right toward him. Han's saber slashed again. One more rope down, but still, Michael was being dragged, hands and elbows locking around his head and face to protect it, his shirt ripping away from his body, rocks gouging at him. He could see Hahn, riding in the dust of the one remaining executioner, Han's pistol aimed. The rider fell, and the horse slowed just enough for Michael to throw himself forward. He grabbed the rope with both hands, both his arms nearly ripped from the sockets, the rope tensioning between his ankle and his hands. He saw Hahn, trying to gain on the animal, saw the jet-black motorcycle, one of the specials, the one his father rode, closing, cutting through mounting Mongol horsemen and Maoist soldiers kneeling to fire their rifles. The horse dragging Michael ran wildly onward toward the rocks, the special closer now, nearly alongside him as Michael struggled to raise his head, his grip going, his hands bleeding where the rope abraded them.
I'm coming, son!
The jet-black special passed him, dust flying into his face, rock chips spitting up toward him. He spotted his father's left gloved hand moving and a flash of gleaming metal. Through blurred vision, Michael spotted his father coming back for him on his motorcycle. He had only enough energy for a weak smile before his head started throbbing again. Natalia Tyamarovna wheeled her machine toward John Rourke, the Mongol riding up on him, throwing away his Astrakhan hat. It was Hahn, but from behind him, a dozen riders were bearing down toward John and Michael.
Natalia, what are you doing?
Clearing the way!
Natalia worked the firing mechanism on both machine guns.
That seemed to work out rather well. I see a squad. They're mine.
Natalia spotted what seemed like an endless stream of soldiers pouring from the gates of the second city. She turned the motorcycle in an almost too fast arc and activated the high explosive grenades in the rear weapons pods. She arced the machine again, her machine guns trained on the entrance. She could see Annie and Paul, Paul's machine rocking across the steps leading onto the platform, guns blazing, white-robed women there fleeing, Mongols dying. Annie was right behind him. They were going after the Russian officer, she realized. She thought she caught sight of Paul getting the man onto Annie's machine, then remounting. But she had to turn her machine, cutting a wedge now between a platoon-strength-sized group of uniformed soldiers and where John and Hahn helped Michael onto the back of John's special. She read the digital counter for rounds remaining, both machine guns nearly emptied now. She switched to a gas and smoke capsule for crowd control. Thick clouds of noxious gas obscured the battle. She knew their helmets would keep Paul and Annie safe, but just to make sure... The mini grenades in the high explosives pod plowed across the ground as they exploded in series on impact, making the dirt and rocks between her and the soldiers rise momentarily like a wave. She turned her bike, her heart beating so rapidly in her chest that she could feel it pounding against her left breast, her mouth so dry she could not swallow, pain behind her eyes.
I love you, John. I will always love you, John.
Her mind, she knew, was working on two levels. On one, she was rationally aware of turning her special right, aiming for a pack of Mongols on foot. On the other, her thoughts raced equally fast toward John Rourke.
John, I'm so lonely without you. John!
Natalia, what's the matter?
This is Maria checking in. The chief of the helicopter pilots has radioed back, Dr. Rourke. He and the other two pilots encountered a massive Soviet force closing on the second city. Two helicopters already shot down. He is on fire and out of control. We have no help coming.
Understood. Stay concealed in those rocks.
Daddy, we've got the Russian officer. He's more dead than alive, I think.
Head out of here!
John, please love me! Ah!
Natalia fired out her machine guns and the counters read out empty. She stopped her machine, slinging her M16 forward.
I don't... Oh, John! I hurt!
Her chest was tightening and her head ached beyond any pain she had ever known. She put the M16 to her shoulder and aimed for the oncoming men.
Natalia, get out of there! We're clear! Get out of there!
John!
Rourke could just barely make out her image from the distance. She was firing, then dropping the rifle as it went empty. She seemed to fumble a bit, then fell from the saddle with a racking spasm.
Natalia!
John! Oh, John!
Natalia! Natalia! Oh, damn it! Hammerschmidt, meet me, now!
Rourke veered toward the German commando captain, gunfire arcing toward them. They were too far for marksmanship, but they only needed one lucky shot. This had to be quick.
Hammerschmidt, take Michael. I'm going back for Natalia.
I can get her here, Doctor.
No, only me.
Rourke was out of the saddle, shifting Michael's unconscious form onto the back of Hammerschmidt's bike, giving Hammerschmidt half the length of rope by which he had tied Michael in place.
Get up into the rocks, start marshaling people together. Get Maria on a bike and start heading out. Cut a tangent to the east and you should avoid Soviet gunships. I'll catch up to you. Be on the lookout for Han. And hurry, Paul's in charge.
Rourke didn't wait for a reply. He pulled down the visors and stuffed the rope down inside his sweater.
Everybody, take off out of here on a tangent from here in the direction of the first city, but eastward. I'll catch up with you. Don't wait. I'm bringing Natalia.
Daddy, what's wrong with her?
Never mind. Paul, can you hear me?
Gotcha.
You're running things until I catch up. Get everybody out of there quick and don't use the radio you left with Maria. They can triangulate in on us.
Well, let me...
I'm doing this alone, Paul. You take care of Annie.
Already, Rourke's machine was bearing down on Natalia's position, his gun still carrying over a half load. Behind him, troops were pouring from inside the second city. He decided to fix that with a high-explosive weapons pod. The ground vibrated around him, and as he glanced back, smoke and flames belched skyward.
John! John!
I'm coming, Natalia.
Rourke cut a swath between her position and the advancing Maoist regulars with his second high-explosive package. He spotted Han, riding toward her on horseback.
Han! Take Natalia's machine! Han!
The Chinese intelligence agent waved back at him. He dropped prone beside Natalia, grabbing up one of her M16s. He worked, pulling her back behind her machine for cover. Rourke looked back, the Maoist regulars advancing once more. He fired one of the gas smoke mixes to hold them off.
Now! While we had the time!
Rourke looked up, sensing a change in the battle. He immediately saw it. The sky seemed black with the insect-like shapes of Soviet gunships coming fast to their position.
Shit.
Rourke jumped from the machine as he put out the stand. He got behind cover beside Natalia and Han Luchen, a scoremaster in each fist. Even with the gunships in the air, the most pressing matter was the foot soldiers.
You take Natalia's bike. Get out of here. Head away from here on a tangent to the east and catch up with the others. I'll be right behind you. I think her weapon systems are exhausted, so just drive like hell.
But I have never...
With the right-hand grip, that's the throttle. Work the left side and that's the brakes. Once you catch up, let Maria Lloyden drive. You ride behind. Don't let the speedometer get up over 60, and don't try to do anything abruptly. Otherwise, it's just like riding a horse. Help me with Natalia. Hurry.
I hope to see you soon, John Rourke.
Yeah, you will.
He was into the saddle, Han balancing Natalia behind him.
Now,
Natalia, can you hear me?
Tears streamed from her eyes, the eyes widely dilated, her neck vibrating with her pulse. If she heard him, she didn't know it. John Rourke had planned ahead, using only half the rope.
Tie her to my shoulders. Hurry!
Okay, she's all tied.
Thanks! Now go!
Rourke took the rope ends and tied them himself while Han ran for Natalia's machine. Rourke took a quick look around. Strafing runs from above, gunfire from the Chinese troops on the ground. They thought that his attack had been part of the Soviet attack, he realized. Han was into the saddle, the special almost lurching out from beneath him. But he held on, low over the handlebars, the machine zigzagging maddeningly.
Natalia, hold on, sweetheart.
Rourke cut in behind Han Luchen, Han's machine evening out, speeding away, Rourke holding back. Han was nearly to the edge of the valley, Soviet gunships hovering there, ropes dropping from them, black-clad elite corps airborne elements rappelling fluidly to the ground. Han was clear.
John!
Rourke looked back. The only way out lay through the Maoists and Mongols, the way he'd come in. Rourke checked his fairing-mounted guns. Maybe enough ammo. One more package of smoke and gas. The 629, his M16, the two Detonics miniguns, still loaded. Rourke began to accelerate, working the machine guns in short bursts, the ground around him furrowing under strafing runs from the Soviet gunships above. Maoists and Mongols in front of him, on either side, firing handguns and rifles, bullets whining off the fairing, his head reeling, his ears ringing. He kept the special rolling, faster and faster, the digital speedometer at 40 now. A concentration of Mongols were closing in behind him on horseback. They could hit Natalia. Rourke activated his last smoke and gas package. The group slowed and started to fall back. A Soviet gunship flew directly over him. It wasn't shooting at him, but an errant round. Drawing the 629, he braked, the helicopter passing over him. The revolver was immediately in position. The helicopter veered suddenly to starboard. Whether it was hit or not, he didn't know and didn't care. The revolver into his belt, he gunned the special ahead, his left hand snatching at one of the miniguns in the double Alessi ring. A Mongol hurled himself down from the saddle, but Rourke was ready for him. The special bumped up and over the body. The ground was beginning to rise toward the rocks ahead. The Russians finally realized he was here. A Soviet gunship crossed nearly at eye level in front of him, and he swerved the special, accelerated out of the skid, up into the rocks. Gunfire from the helicopters tore into the rocks around him, the speedometer reading 110, a straight run ahead now. Rourke was accelerating. 120, 130, 135. The ground rippled and furrowed on either side of him. As he looked up, there were two gunships in pursuit. Aerial mines fell. Rourke swerved the machine right and left, recovering just in time, then almost losing control again. 140, 145. The ground was starting to drop off. His only hope, he had realized since the pursuit had begun moments ago, was to give the gunships nothing to pursue. He angled the fork left, the ground dropping quickly now, rising steeply ahead. He accelerated, 152. The machine, with the added weight of a second rider and the bumpy terrain, was almost impossible to control now.
I'm here, Natalia!
The ground rose sharply, the terrain slick rock beneath him, high rock walls on either side of him, and suddenly, nothing there in front of him. John Rourke had planned ahead, gunning the last mile per hour of speed out of the special as it jumped. Rourke's hands left the controls, tugging open the knot binding Natalia's body to his. The rushing water of the river 50 feet below, 40, 30, as he twisted in the saddle, folding Natalia into his arms. He leapt to throw themselves clear as the machine rocketed toward the turbulent surface. Rourke held tight to Natalia as they went under, his body screaming from having taken the force for them both after the special broke the water. Bullets carved channels in the river, their momentum absorbed long before they could reach the people below. John Rourke had stripped away her wet clothes except for her underwear, wrapped her in the disposable insulated blanket he carried in the musette bag. But he could not risk a fire by which to warm her. The radio in his helmet and hers either no longer worked, or Annie, Paul, and the others were too far out of range to pick up. His handguns were reloaded, and he would, one at a time, disassemble and clean them. The revolver more challenging in the field like this, but not impossible. The ammunition he would have to bank on still functioning. But that was the advantage of a knife. It never ran out, and the grain knife he had wiped down immediately, then left out of the sheath until the sheath began to dry. He shivered with the cold. The special was lost. The smoke was dense in the distance where the second city was, Soviet gunships making passes everywhere in the sky above. They were hidden in an inch of rock, invisible from the air, as best he could discern. He stripped away his wet clothes and huddled into the blanket with Natalia, her body trembling with cold as he held her to warm her. They were miles inside hostile territory, and at least here, in the middle of full-scale war, without transportation, without communications. Natalia, gravely ill, in a state it appeared of total mental collapse. For now, until cover of darkness, there was nothing to do but wait and warm her. The tears had stopped, but the surrealistically blue eyes only stared vacantly away.
John! John!
Shh! John. I'm here, John. Natalia. I'm John. Here.
John!
Survivalist: The Arsenal is a Graphic Audio production. Copyright 1987, Jerry Ahern. Published by arrangement with Jerry and Sharon Ahern, all rights reserved. Production copyright 2009, The Cutting Corporation, all rights reserved. Performed by Terence Aselford, Mort Shelby, Nanette Savard, Ren Casey, M.B. Van Dorn, Eric Messner, Michael Glenn, James Konacek, Elizabeth Jernigan, Richard Rowan, Dolores King-Williams, Jeff Baker, Tony Nam, David Coyne, Christopher Graybill, Lily Beacon, Stephen Carpenter, Michael John Casey, Tim Getman, Joe Brack, Tom Simpson, and Dylan Lynch. Additional red shirts by The Dead Giveaways. Directed by Terence Aselford. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Dialogue editing and graphic audio sound design by Nathaniel Perry. Adapted for graphic audio by Dan Smith. If you enjoyed The Survivalist, be sure to look for Ryder Stacey's Doomsday Warrior, available at road stops everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net, where you'll find samples of all our Action Pump titles, as well as free downloadable extras, forums, and podcasts. Keep listening for a preview of another title in Graphic Audio.
Smoke Jensen is a man with blood on his hands.
Do you have any idea of the numbers of graves I've got on my back trail? Enough to populate a fair-sized town, and then some.
He finds himself coming to a crossroads. The price he must pay for all that killing is something that Smoke will no longer bear.
I'm tired of all the blood. I'm tired of all the killing. I'm tired of the looks people give me. I'm tired of being the most notorious gun in all the so-called Wild West. I hope I never have to pull a gun in anger again.
But that was before Smoke ever knew the name of Frederick Von Hausen.
Jensen! Smoke Jensen! Your time has come to die! Not by a faster gun, but by a man who is much more intelligent than you. You'll see, Jensen. You'll see.
When the pompous German aristocrat looking for the ultimate thrill kill comes beating down Smoke Jensen's door, Smoke will be pushed to the very limits of his endurance.
No man will talk down to me and expect to live. I'll stand and fight. And when I decide to do that, I won't be taking any prisoners for trial.
When there are no other options, sometimes violence is the only way.
You're all gonna die.
Don't miss a second of the brutally violent action in Smoke Jensen number 9, Pursuit of the Mountain Man. Rivers of blood will flow.
If you can't find that graphic audio title you're looking for, go to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD format or digital download. If you're on the road, call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220 or www.graphicaudio.net. And if you're looking for a great way to try out a different graphic audio series, check out our convenient and easy-to-store long-haul box sets that include 5 books of a series, available only at www.graphicaudio.net.